So this is Ophir's first real talk of this 9-day meditation retreat. I must admit I never really put too much effort into the first talk in the evening of a retreat. I realize that that's people settling down, and whatever you really say there, it doesn't really get registered too much. But after people have rested, settled in, had a breakfast, their minds are much more open. And you'll find as the retreat continues, the mind will get even more open. So usually try and keep the best talks to later on. But still, we're here at the beginning. We need some instructions on meditation. And many of you have been to many retreats, been to my retreats, other people's retreats. You've read, you've listened on the internet, got so much information about what meditation is. And so I'm not going to repeat what you already know. I'm not going to repeat what you can read in books. I'm going to try and capture the essence of meditation to take it much deeper. Because with all that knowledge, with all that reading, that how come that some of you still can't keep your mind very peaceful and still? And I think that sometimes too much information just confuses the mind. One thing I said last night is very important. Is the nature of meditation is to bring the mind to a state of stillness. And I've made a big thing about questioning the translation of samadhi as concentration. And I question that because it's not just an academic matter. The very meaning of the word concentration just implies a sense of force and control. And you'll find that if a person does get concentrated, that state of concentration is very tense, it's tight. And I know because I've been there many times, you can get quite deep with concentration. But you come across the brick wall, you can't go further, because the mind just cannot let go. It's tight, controlled, holding, fixed. Fixed not through stillness and peace and emptiness, but fixed through force. And people who do get very concentrated that way, who do exert a lot of effort and willpower, usually are very proud and arrogant because they have big egos. And I notice through insight, it's the willpower which creates the ego. Big willpower, big ego, big sense of self. Because it's the sense of self, your achievements, your strengths, your successes. That is the bricks which make up the house of the self. So, we're going in a different direction. You'll find some of you haven't tried this path before. You may find it a bit confusing. Confusing not in the sense that it's illogical, irrational. It all seems very clear. It makes sense, but it's unusual because it's a path. As the book says, a path less travelled. It's a path which very few people have the courage to walk along. It's a path of letting go of that sense of self, of just letting things be, of not sort of controlling the process, but letting things evolve. I know that many of my teachers would often use a simile of planting a tree. You plant the tree, put it in the ground, and you leave it alone. Your job is just to guard it from being hurt, guard it from being injured, guard it from any dangers. That's all you have to do. And the tree will grow by itself. If you put fast fertilizer on it, you just kill it. If you try and make it grow quicker, it will just be destroyed. Even though you may have what you think is your schedule, you have to have the tree grown and finished before a certain time. It doesn't do that. Just this morning I just was checking out some of the work of our anagarikas and monks who are just putting the mulch on that garden just below the lower cottages. They're doing a very nice job down there, looking at the trees there. They're very small trees now, and I probably won't be alive to see them when they grow to their full maturity. It's something I probably won't see, unless, as many people ask me to do, that I live to 120 years of age. But If I do live that long, I'll probably be blind anyway, so I still won't see them. But even though you don't see them, it's a beautiful thing to do. Yeah, somebody else would appreciate that garden, those trees. And I can't make them grow quicker. I can't hurry them along so I can see that garden when it's in its full maturity. And the same, I know that with my meditation. I just can't hurry it along. In fact, the more I hurry it, the more I hinder its development. Because I know this path of meditation, like growing a tree, is the tree is there, the seedling is there. You've to nurture it, you've got to guard it. But don't interfere with its natural process. That is actually how your mind will work. And that's why it's so difficult to do, because we're such interferers. And again, I don't know how long you've all been here. Some have just arrived this morning. Some have been here quite a few days. Some was doing back-to-back retreats. But I'm sure that quite a few times you've looked to the kitchen and thought of a better way of doing it. You've looked to your huts and thought of some improvements which could be made. It's just the nature of our mind, just always get involved and interfere with things. We can't just leave things alone. We have to somehow make them better. And that's the problem with your mind. You're always trying to make it better, make it different. Interfere, get involved. And that actually stops meditation happening. You know, sometimes some of you will be meditating for many years, and you just get totally frustrated. Nothing works. And that's a brilliant achievement. The achievement of frustration. Because then you might actually let go. You tried everything. You tried vipassana, you tried samatha, you tried dispassana, you tried that method, you tried every method, and nothing works. You've still got 8 days to go. Ah, brilliant. Now you might actually let go and stop doing things. You've gone through your whole repertoire. And nothing works. So you stop, you give up, you abandon, you let go. You know all those great stories? I usually tell these at the end of the retreat, but they come up now. All those great stories of in the Therigata and the Theragata, these are those books of enlightened monks and nuns in the time of the Buddha. Anyone who says there's no bhikkhunis, there's whole books of bhikkhunis, sort of enlightened ones as well. And this is 2,500 years ago, equity from the very beginning. So, enlightened bhikkhunis. But some of those bhikkhunis, you know, they didn't have an easy time of it. And sometimes you think, oh, you monks, you know, Ajahn Brahm, you were just born in jhana. When you came out of your mother's womb, your legs were crossed. That's not true. Everyone goes through their stuff and has to learn how to do things, and learns how to practice. And this particular nun, she said for 17 years, she'd been meditating and had no peace at all, ever. Imagine that. You just do like 9 days and you get fine. This woman, 17 whole years, she was meditating and never got a moment of peace. There's such endurance, and you just have to praise a person for lasting that long. And after 17 years, she realized she'd, you know, wasted time staying as a nun. She can't meditate, no peace, didn't want to go back to the world. So what she decided to do was to commit suicide. She took a rope and tied one end to the end of a tree trunk, tried the other, made a noose, put it around her neck. She was just about to jump off. In that moment, she was totally letting go of all hope, letting go of her body, letting go of everything. And then she had her first moment of release. She became enlightened. Now, as I often say, we don't recommend that practice for you. Don't try it. But just bringing that up, you can understand what happened. Trying, doing so many things, trying so many different methods, so many teachers, and she eventually just gave up. Now please, don't wait till the end of the retreat to give up. Give up today at the beginning. So you can actually enjoy the rest of the retreat. And there's something of powerful teaching there, that giving up, that letting go of controlling. And then she didn't have to remember all the stages of meditation and all the things you're supposed to do. It happened totally naturally. And that's in the ancient books, and I know many meditators who've done exactly the same. Well, maybe not as deep, but have actually come and told me they've been meditating for years, this teacher, that teacher, this method and that method, and then they decided, oh, I'm just going to give up. And then all these wonderful things which you describe happen. And I mention that because that should be telling you an important lesson. If you are frustrated, if you've been trying so hard for years, if you think you can't meditate, there's something which you're doing wrong. And sometimes just to make, you know, I like sort of saying, not controversial things, but things which stir people up. Because, you know, I give so many talks, and after a while people think I'm going to say the same old thing, and they fall asleep. So you've got to say something which actually wakes people up. And my saying is, I am a hopeless meditator. Ajahn Brahm cannot meditate for his life. I admit that. I can't meditate. Oh my goodness, what have we been looking after this monk for such a long time? Why have we got him as our teacher for the next 9 days? He's admitting he can't meditate. But of course there's a catch to that saying. And the catch is, when I try to meditate, it all goes wrong. When I disappear, then meditation happens. That's why I can't meditate. Ajahn Brahm is a hopeless meditator. When Ajahn Brahm totally vanishes and I disappear, meditation's so easy. So I just, this observer, I just watch all these wonderful things happening. And it's beautiful, it's peaceful, and it's delightful. Have a wonderful time. That's why I even said to someone, whenever I teach a retreat, for me, this is actually a holiday for me. You don't have to worry about sending emails, worrying about what bapong, worrying about going here, people coming, telling you about your divorce or their cancers or the problems with this and problem with that. All I do is just totally be irresponsible. The abbot, the teacher, whatever else it is, I totally vanish. And I have a wonderful time here. Just, yeah, I sort of sit up here and just open my mouth, but it's not me speaking. I totally vanish and disappear. And that's just a beautiful state to be in, because that means that you just allow things to flow naturally. Now that is actually how to meditate. And it's a tough thing to ask you to do, because you're just basically not used to it. It goes against the grain. It goes against your conditioning. There's many indications that this was the path which the Buddha was teaching. One of those great stories was just before he became enlightened. And it's in the mythology of Buddhism. It's a little story which everyone repeats, which doesn't really make much sense. It doesn't seem to add anything to the story. In fact, it seems a bit magical, which is really weird. But there is an important meaning to that story, which very few people explain. And that's the time when the Buddha took his alms bowl, actually before he was a Buddha, put it in the river Nirvana, and he said, according to the story, I make a resolution, if my bowl flows against the stream, then it's a sign I'll become enlightened. If it goes with the current, it's a sign that no, I'm not going to become enlightened. And of course, the bowl went against the stream. And everyone takes that story as some sort of magic omen, like a prediction of what was about to be happening. And of course, you should all know that such predictions and such omens have very little to do with real Buddhism. So what's that doing in the story of the Buddha's enlightenment? And of course, once you learn how to meditate, you understand precisely what that story is meaning. It was not saying that he was going to become enlightened. It was telling him how to become enlightened. And from that time, the Buddha always said to go against the stream of craving. And what that actually means is not having other craving. So I have desires and I crave not to have desires. Now I am restless and I crave not to be restless. Not I'm tired and I crave not to be tired. That's not going against the stream of craving. That's just creating more craving, whirlpools in the stream which keep going round and round. Going against the stream of craving means having no craving, stopping craving, doing a different path. So I challenge you, on this retreat, go against craving. Stop it. say no to it. Don't do anything. And what do I mean by that? You're sitting here. What on earth do you want? Where are you trying to get? What are you doing this for? What's the purpose of exerting your will? Where are you trying to go to? Some of you are trying to attain jhanas, and you haven't got a clue what jhanas are. You just heard it from people like me saying it's better than sex, incredible bliss, beautiful lights, wonderful things happening, razzmatazz, all the bells and whistles, woo. But do you really think that's what it's like? It's not like that at all. There's a great saying of the Buddha when he was describing the jhanas. Whatever you think it's going to be totally different. It's just not like that. So you're actually aiming for things you totally don't understand, aiming for things which don't exist. What Ajahn Chah said, searching for the tortoise with a moustache. Another sort of his jokey phrase is, the tortoise with a moustache. All you're wanting is searching for a tortoise with a moustache. It never gets you to where you want to go. And you spent all your life doing that, wanting, craving, trying to get this, trying to go there. Does it really ever give you real satisfaction and peace? Maybe for a few moments, a few days, but not real deep peace, fulfillment, freedom. After a while you should get the message that that's the wrong direction. You are going with the stream of craving rather than against it. And even in meditation retreats, for many people it's just another type of craving again. You've got all these goals, what you want to achieve. And sometimes you hear that we shouldn't have any goals, so I'm going to achieve having no goals. And it becomes another form of craving. You can see just how complicated your mind can become. So look, we don't do any of that at all. If you really want to get some peace, just give up. Let go. Don't try anything. And then this amazing thing happens when you actually push the letting go button, as I say. It's a tough thing to do. Incredibly difficult. It's so subtle because you're just not used to it. It's at first like groping in the darkness. You just don't know your way. Because everything which you can recognize life by, you being involved, you willing, you directing things, all your landmarks are taken away. So at first it does feel, this is really weird and strange. Which is why a lot of people just haven't got the guts and the courage to really let go. But you remember those words. And every now and again, you will just leave things alone. And everything gets so peaceful and nice. And then the thought comes up, it's working. This is the way I can do it now. And it all goes wrong again. You've interfered, baby. Stop it. Keep your hands out of the whole mix. Because you have to just be totally passive. Let go. Because otherwise your mind will never find that state of stillness. How can doing things keep things still? How can getting involved allow things just to be calm? Every time you form an act of will, you get involved, you have a want, you want to do something. Every time you're actually stirring up this mind. It's an ancient metaphor, not just in Buddhism, but through so many cultures. It's like a symbol, which is almost primordial, for the mind to be considered like a lake. And it's a very useful simile as well. I think even Freud had that. When you look at the mind as a big lake, and if you understand that the purpose of meditation is to get that lake totally still. So there's not a wave, not a ripple on the surface of that body of water. If you understand that that is what meditation is all about, then you're getting somewhere. You have a visual image which will help you understand what's needed. Because every time you touch that water, every time you put your hand in, every time you try and make it still, you just create more waves. And you just move further away from stillness. Every time you want something, you move backwards. Not towards deeper meditation, but away from it. You're stirring up and troubling and agitating your own mind. So our job, our effort, our mindfulness should be to guard, protect, to stop ourselves interfering. The mindfulness should be put on there to say, like guards of a nightclub. The guards, the bouncers of a nightclub have to make sure that no troublemakers come into the club. And your mindfulness is set up to make sure that no troublemakers come into your meditation to disturb and stop you becoming still. And I think you understand who those troublemakers are. Just wanting, judging, assessing, all those sorts of cravings. Those are the troublemakers. So your mindfulness, the bouncers of a nightclub, the guards, they've got to be on the lookout to make sure none of this wanting comes in. I think for a couple of years, my meditation, this was when I was wandering through Thailand on my two dong years, my meditation was just a little mantra I would keep reciting to myself, no desire, no desire, no desire. And so that was my instructive, my mindfulness. And if I saw any desire come into my mind, any wanting at all while I was cross-legged, I would stomp on it. That's metaphorically speaking. I just wouldn't allow it to persist. Any desire, even for good things, let alone desires for bad things, I would be mindful when they came, and I would abandon them almost immediately. So you meditate for hours with not a desire in the world, not a want, not wanting to be anywhere else, not wanting to achieve anything, just being with no desire, mindful without interfering, accepting everything. And those beautiful meditations, you really got very deep. You could sit for hours. Why could I sit for hours? Nothing else to do. I was wanting for nothing. The wanting, because it kept on being resisted, after a while just settled down and didn't come up again, which gave my leg, my mind, a chance to become very still indeed. And once you experience what that type of meditation can do, you just realize just what meditation is all about. Sometimes people get afraid. They get afraid because when you first start to do this type of meditation where you totally let go, you don't interfere, you disappear. When you first start to do this, things start to get a little bit crazy. For most of you, you go into dullness. Please don't be afraid of dullness. Just recently, just was talking with the monks one evening, and one of the sisters, they asked a question, because for years I've been telling the simile of the Buddha seeing the two monks. One of those monks was sitting perfectly straight back, cross-legged, not moving at all, and the Buddha was upset and said, I'm worried about that monk. And the other monk, he saw deeper in the forest, was actually nodding. He was sitting there, nodding this way, nodding that way, half asleep, and the Buddha was happy. He said, I'm happy about that monk. I always thought that was from the commentaries. But Ajahn Brahmadi said, no, it's Anangutu Nikaya. It's the teaching straight of the Buddha. And it's a beautiful simile, especially for those of you who are not that restless, but have dullness every now and again, that sometimes you meditate and you fall asleep. The Buddha will be proud of you. And it's in there, Anguttara 6 and Anguttara 8. It's twice in there. But, you know, of course, when I first saw that, and why I teach that, because that's challenging you. That most of you say, that doesn't make sense. I've had teachers, and if they see me nodding, they hit me with a stick. That's in the Zen tradition. And when I was growing up as a monk, not as a monk, as a lay Buddhist, I was in England, 1971 or 72, I went to this Zen monastery in the north of England, because it was the only place you could meditate. You didn't have any choice. It was like a Tibetan center or a Zen center, and I was close by the Zen center. I went there for a weekend retreat. And I wasn't sort of a Zen. I just didn't mind whatever type of Buddhism, as long as I could have a nice quiet time meditating. And my goodness, this teacher, he would come with the stick. And I remember this, I think it was a Sunday morning. You know what it's like. We had to get up at 4 o'clock, whatever it was. And you're all sitting there, and it's freezing cold. And when it's freezing cold, you tend to huddle, you tend to go down. And this guy came in with a stick. And I was sleepy, but I had very good karma. I've always been a very, very lucky monk, because it was a person sitting next to me who was the most sleepy. So he got hit first. And my goodness, whack! As soon as I heard that, I was perfectly straight. I had no slot of torpor at all. That was through fear. And I thought, that's really crazy. That's not how you're supposed to do things. And if you tried that in our Buddhist society, West Australia, someone would sue you for that. I'd have paid damages, both physical and emotional, for years. But the point is that there's missing a lot there. So it's not the bodily position which is the point, it's your mental attitude. And anyway, that mental attitude of that monk who was nodding was one of letting go. The mental attitude of that monk who was perfectly straight was one of control. The control freak monk. And I've seen many meditators here, you can sit perfectly straight. You're a control freak. You're putting forth so much effort just to keep your body straight, you can never find any peace in your mind. I see others of you nodding this way, nodding that way. And I smile at you. Well done. Because what you're doing, at least you're letting things go. You're letting nature be. Because as I mentioned to you, you're not used to getting up early. You're not used to the lack of stimulation in a retreat. This is weird for most of you. You can talk at home, you can watch movies, the TV, going to the shopping mall. The sensory stimulation outside of this center here is huge. And now you're coming here, you can't talk with each other, nothing to look at, there's no shops here, there's no movies, you can't even get a mobile phone call. There's nothing to stimulate you at all. So you are going to get dull. It's nothing to do with you. It's not your fault. Even the Buddha, if he was a layperson living in Perth or Singapore or wherever else you've come from, and he came to this retreat, he'd be dull too. It's just cause and effect. So don't worry about that. Don't fight it. Love your sloth and torpor. Be kind to it. Let it be. And then it disappears the fastest, because you're not interfering. When you let go, all the defilements come up pretty quickly, simply because you've just been suppressing them. Holding them back, they have to come out and come through and leave you. So that's why, please, for the first few days, allow yourself to be sleepy. And if you're sitting in this room and you feel really sleepy, tell yourself, Ajahn Brahm will be proud of me. And I would. So don't fight it. Love it. Make peace with it. Be kind to it. And then you'll find it doesn't last that long. It's just getting rid of some old karma, the physical and mental tiredness because of your lifestyle. And then, when that disappears, because you haven't interfered at all, then the meditation really starts to take off. Sloth and torpor disappear, but it's peace. Beautiful peace. Where's that peace come from? It's just because you haven't been disturbing your lake. And the waves are getting less and less and less. And you just continue. You know that the longer you don't interfere, the longer you don't disturb, the more that lake is going to become still. More and more and more still. And for those of you who wonder about insight, because somehow or other that's been brainwashed into you, this meditation has also got to give you insight. Yes, of course it gives you insight. When a lake has waves on it, it will never be able to reflect accurately the mountains and forests surrounding it. It won't be able to reflect accurately the full moon in the night sky. The image will be distorted because of the undulations on the surface of the water. But when that water is perfectly still, without a ripple, we call it glassy smooth, like a mirror, because it does reflect the forest and the mountains surrounding the lake. It does reflect the stars and the full moon. You can see it perfectly, an accurate mirror image, simply because the lake is perfectly still. And that is a very accurate description of how insight happens. When the mind is moving, it distorts the image of life. You all know that through thinking. How many times thoughts and opinions have deceived you? And many of you, I hope, have had the insight that when your mind is still, all the answers become very clear. Just even a couple of days ago, someone came and they said they wanted to ask me all these questions. They said, I just come in here, I feel so peaceful, I don't want to ask any more questions. That so reminded me of when I went to see this great monk Ajahn Tate years ago. You know, he's a difficult monk to catch and had to travel a long distance. And when I got there with all my questions and managed to get the appointment to go into his room to get a personal interview with this great monk, my mind was perfectly quiet. I had no more questions. I went all this way to get the answers. And as soon as you went in there, your mind was blank. I realized that was the answer I was really wanting. Because all the other questions you have, that's just movement of the mind. You get those questions answered. And does it really end with the questions? In the evening, we're going to have question time. And I always thought when I sort of had this idea of having a question time, you write questions on a piece of paper, you put it in a basket. I thought that, you know, as you meditated longer and longer, you know, as you got more answers, there'd be less questions. But we all know that as the retreat goes, there's more and more pieces of paper in that basket. Why is that the case? Because the more questions you ask, the more questions you have. Why is that? Because you're just stimulating and stirring up the mind. When you put a wave on the surface of the lake, it just makes more waves. You keep on interfering. So the way to get insight, the way to end and get the answer to all questions, is to be so still, so peaceful. There are no more questions. And that's the answer. The answer is not another question. It's the end of all questions. And that's what you experience. With a nice and still, peaceful mind. So I mention these things because I know that some people come on retreats and they want, okay, what's the first stage of meditation? Please, Ajahn Bob, tell me what to do. At least tell me how to sit. Is my left leg supposed to go on my right leg? My right leg go on my left leg? Where am I supposed to put my hands? Is it okay to sit on a cushion, to sit with my... Should I sit on a chair? Give me instructions. And I refuse to do that. And there's a reason for that. Because I wanted to take it out, this idea of you always being told what to do and always having these rules of how you should do things. Because that is really just stopping you, finding out for yourself, even how you sit. Look, how to meditate. That story, I was there at the time under Ajahn Chah's hut. That's where he used to receive guests. It's this hut on stilts. Upstairs was where he lived. Downstairs was an open area. He used to sit on this wicker chair receiving guests all day. That's why I don't do that, because that killed him. So he's receiving guests all day. One day this professor came from Sweden. This must have been in 1978 or 9 or something, or somewhere around that time. They'd heard that meditation was important, and the Swedish government being very advanced, but please don't tell Ajahn Brahmali about that, because Norwegians don't get on with the Swedes. But anyway, there's a very advanced government, and they actually sent a professor to India, Southeast Asia, to go to all the famous gurus and meditation masters in the East to find out what the heck this meditation was. And whether it worked. So being a professor, If you're doing research, you have to standardize your questions. And that's what he did. He had four questions. The same four questions he was asking all the gurus and masters of the East. And he'd already been through India and been through many masters in Thailand, and now he came to see Ajahn Chah. So with great pomp, because Ajahn Chah respected people who were sent by governments, he asked him, what were your questions? And the translator translated them into Thai. And the four questions were, what is meditation? How do you meditate? Why do you meditate? And what do you get out of meditation? The four questions. And when he gave it to Ajahn Chah, you know, he wrote down these answers and had the translator explain it to him. And look, that was the only time I've seen Ajahn Chah write anything down. So as soon as he asked the pen and paper, it was a sign that people knew, you know, that this was going to be interesting. He was messing around. He was playing. You know, you see me being playful, okay? And sometimes it's okay for monks to be playful. Like after the last evening's talk, we ran to the door to try, so I could open it before other people could open it, so I could actually let you through. And if you saw me last night, just after the talk here running, I'm a playful monk, and many of you know that. So was Ajahn Chah. That's why it was so interesting to be around him. And this was him being playful again, asking for a piece of paper, scratching his head. He was acting. He was playing up, because he never does that in real life. And so it made us be really interesting. Something's happening here. This is going to be one of those experiences we're going to remember, and we're going to give in our talks later on, which I'm doing now. And when he gave the answers out, of course, the translator burst out laughing. It took a while to compose himself to actually to translate into English. And again, with great respect for the professor, he said, "The Ajahn Chah, my master's considered and deep answer to your first question, what is meditation? His answer is this." The professor was listening. "The answer is, what is eating?" The professor looked very confused. "Your second question, so how do you meditate?" His answer is, "How do you eat?" Third question, "Why do you meditate?" His answer, "Why do you eat?" And the fourth question, "What do you get out of meditation?" The great master's insightful answer is, "What do you get out of eating?" And that professor got really angry. He said, "I came all the way from Sweden for this. I can't take that back to my government." And Ajahn Chah said, "That's all you're getting." But the thing was, he wasn't just playing around. That was an incredibly deep answer. I mean, second question, how do you meditate? That's what you've come here to listen for, isn't it? Come, Ajahn Brahm is going to teach me how to meditate. And some of you have been coming for years. And obviously, I don't know, I can't teach you, because if you, I did teach, you'd be able to meditate now, wouldn't you? So either I'm a failure, or you're a failure, or something's going on here. Some of you listen to so many of my talks. You know them backwards. You know all the stories. You know all the jokes. So how come it doesn't work? You're missing something, aren't you? How do you meditate? I'm not telling you how to meditate. I haven't taught you how to meditate. And if I ever think I'm a teacher and I've taught you how to meditate, you've missed the plot. How do you eat? Did anyone ever tell you how to eat? Yeah, they told you etiquette, you know, not to slurp, you know, not to sort of drool with it. It's etiquette in meditation, so don't make any noise when you're meditating. You know, please don't sort of disturb the people around you. That's meditation etiquette. But how you meditate, how you eat, this is this beautiful natural process. All you ever do when you teach meditation is teach people what not to do. What you actually are doing in meditation is something totally different. How do you eat? And it's something which does come naturally to people when they stop interfering. You sit there. And you just do nothing. Sit here and be totally peaceful. Going against all craving. Not wanting anything. Not trying to get anything. Not trying to be anything. As I said this morning, from that beautiful Metta Sutta, being content and easily satisfied. not proud and wanting things, not demanding in nature. That's how you meditate, being content. See how much contentment you can build up with every moment. You know, this might not be the best. You might not be enlightened yet. You may have all these problems, but it's pretty good. I mean, you're not in Libya right now. You know, you're not sort of in the hospice about to die. You're not sort of in Guantanamo Bay being tortured. So it's pretty good being here. Can't you be content? I mean, this beautiful Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. You're being fed morning and evening. There's no cost. You have no financial worries. You don't have problems with relationships. We keep 8 precepts. So you don't have to wonder about, what does she think about me? What does he think about me? You know, does he like me? Should I sort of wear different types of clothes? Should I do my hair different? You don't have to worry about anything. It's just so peaceful and so wonderful and so free being here. If you can't be content here, you can't be content anywhere. I mean, what more do you want? So this should be easy to be content. The trouble is, yeah, it's nice out here, but I want the jhanas. I want at least a nimitta. I want. Every time you want something, you're creating discontent. So sometimes I tell myself that. I sit down, what do I want? And every time I find out, you know, what my mind was aiming for, I said, look, if you get there, what's going to happen? Is that really going to satisfy you? It's not. So shut up. Do you want to win the lottery? Do you want to be a millionaire? Do you want to be those people of my age? Do you want to be 20 again? Do you want to be fit and healthy? Do you want to start all over again and fix it all up? What do you really want? I mean, come on, get real. You know, if I was a genie and I gave you 3 wishes, what would you want? And if you're smart, you'd say to that genie, I want you to piss off. Get out of here. Stop stirring me up. I don't want any wants at all. Now that is a real mug. Well, if the genie came to you, what would you say? I want world peace. Come on, world peace? Can we get real? This is the world. That's one of those oxymorons. World, peace, they don't fit together. When there's a world, there'll be wars. It's nature, isn't it? Okay, we try and make it peaceful, but, you know, there's other ways of doing it. Like what you're doing here, this is the best way to get world peace. But what else do you want? I want to be free of all sickness. Yeah? Is that possible? Do you know any person in this world who's free of sickness? We all get sick. We're all going to die. Oh, I want to live to 120 years of age, as I said this morning. That's a stupid thing. 120 years of age. I'm halfway there and I'm already still starting to fall apart. By 120, it'd just be things hanging off. I'd be rattling all over the place. I'd be a right mess. What do you want? So if you can't even tell for the genie to piss off, at least you can actually say, that's how you say to Mara. Mara, I know you. Get out of here. That's the genie giving you wants. If you can't even say to that, you think to yourself, what do I want? I don't know. What do I want? Nothing. So wonderful being a monk. Because sometimes people do that to you, you know. When I was in Sri Lanka, people offered me a retreat center. They said, Ajahn Brahm, we'll build you a whole retreat center anywhere in Sri Lanka, any design, money no object, whatever you want. We'll give it to you. It's like a genie. This incredibly wealthy family. They just wanted me to sort of teach retreats in Sri Lanka. I wouldn't need to bother about it. They come with the designs and say, yeah, this is my room. You know, the air con, the nice sofas, the tea machine, fish and chips every day. No, I don't like fish and chips every day. But I had this. I could do whatever I want. They can give me this retreat center. Totally, have no fundraising, just incredible amount of money, whatever you want. And I said, no, thank you. Very wonderful when you can say things like that. Some other people have come up and said, Bob, we want to get you something special just for you. What can we get for you? I said, nothing. It's nice being a monk who doesn't want anything. That gives me an incredible amount of happiness. Can you do that? If someone came up to you and said, "Oh, you know, you're such a nice person. Is there anything you want?" Would you have a list? Or would you have a blank sheet of paper? Now you can understand what peace is and contentment is, and just how much happiness that gives you, being free of wants. Maybe you can't do that in your life outside, but for the next 9 days, see if you can do that. See if you can create that state of mind that a genie appeared in front of you and gave you any wishes, no matter how much money, whatever you want in your whole life, that you would actually turn to that genie and say, "Don't want anything. Leave." If you can do that, then you know how to meditate. Just being peaceful, being free. You can see how much joy and happiness that brings you. And it's that joy and happiness, that's what we're trying to create in this meditation. A beautiful sense of contentment, peace, freedom from desires. That's one of the things which I indicated years ago. The two types of freedom in our world. The freedom of desires. You're rich, powerful, smart enough to get whatever you want whenever you want it. That's your freedom of desires. You got your wealth, you got your investments, you got your income. Which means that if I want to, "Yeah, I just want to go to Bali for a holiday. Yeah, I just go off to Bali for a holiday. I want to get a nice meal. Some nice spaghetti. What would you like to eat right now?" It's great being in this monastery. You can't choose what you eat. It's there. You've got the two choices which Bianca gives you. Take it or leave it. That's our menu this for lunchtime. That's great when you've got no choice. It's so free. But if you can really do that and just be totally peaceful, then you know how to eat. You also know how to meditate. Contentment. And get that idea. Contentment leads to stillness. Contentment is letting go. Being easily satisfied. What more do you want? Where can you ever find satisfaction? I still remember one of my first teachers, Mick Jagger. "I can't get no satisfaction." Some of you, it shows your age if you understood that one. And there was this brilliant rock singer, just gorgeous looking at what my girlfriend used to tell me. Just a really hot guy, rich, powerful, and he couldn't get any satisfaction. And I thought, my goodness, if he can't get any satisfaction, there's no hope for me. So I just realized that let go, be easily satisfied. And you're easily satisfied, and life becomes so peaceful. Now, okay, you get that idea in your head. Yeah, this is what a monk is supposed to be. Yeah, this is what we're supposed to be outside. But do that in your meditation. A lot of people have disconnect between their meditation and being a Buddhist out there in the world. And the Buddhists out there in the world, they're compassionate and kind and forgiving and let go and be peaceful. They get meditation. Crave, crave, crave. Want, want. Criticize, criticize, criticize. Cruel, cruel, cruel. I've been on some meditation retreats, and I've seen people sitting there in front of me, hour after hour, and the expression on their face is precisely as if they were interned by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard and tortured to death. And they're doing it themselves. "My knees hurt, my back aches, I'm in terrible pain, but I'm going to bear it. I'm going to get in line. I'm not I've got those words now. It's this namby-pamby cream puff. That's why. I'm not a namby-pamby cream puff. I'm a real meditator, not one of these stupid Ajahn Brahm let go sort of mucks. I'm really going to get enlightened in this retreat. I'm going to sit here. Even though my bones turn to dust and my blood dries up, I'm not going to move from here. No lunch, no dinner, no tea in the afternoon. That's only just for the, you know, the no-hoper meditators. I'm going to sit here. I'm either going to die on this seat or I'm going to get enlightened. That's me." Yeah, some people are like that. And they've got such incredible ego and arrogance. The willpower. They think that, you know, if I want to get enlightened, I'm going to do it. And people like that, they're nutcases. They're really just, they get sort of wheeled out here in the ambulance with the men in the white coats taking them away. They're the troublemakers, because they're just going totally against sort of the path of meditation. And the thing is that outside of that, this is so kind and forgiving. Vegetarians never harm anyone. They give donations to Amnesty International and to Greenpeace. They're such nice Buddhists. But outside, they're just, oh, they're the opposite. They're the whale hunters, you know, of their mind, always harpooning the defilements. And that is not... And do you understand that disconnect which people have? So please, as you meditate, meditate like a Buddhist. And what do I mean by that? I mean, be gentle, be calm, be kind. Just read stories of the Buddha. He's an incredibly compassionate and kind being. People try to come up and kill him. And he would just forgive them. Oh, never mind. He wouldn't go and call the police and get the guys arrested. Oh, these guys actually came to kill me. They're assassins. Put them away. He said, no, never mind. As long as you acknowledge your faults, forgive and learn, that's fine. This elephant tried to murder him, tried to trample him. Oh, never mind, Nalagiri. If you want to trample me, that's okay. I won't ever hurt. An incredible, kind, compassionate being. And I always try and remember that when I meditate. It's called actually Buddha Anusati. Just the recollection of the Buddha. But I don't mean recollection of the Buddha. The Buddha lived in India, he did this. That's not the recollection of the Buddha. A recollection of what the Buddha really was. Recollecting the mind of a Buddha. And meditating with such a mind. So compassionate. That if it was a stupid thought coming in your mind, the most gross, kinky, violent, stupid thought, you'd say, welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. This beautiful kindness and gentleness and peace, content and easily satisfied, not proud, not demanding in nature. The mind of a Buddha when you meditate. So whatever comes in the mind, thank you for coming to visit me. I don't demand anything of you. I don't want anything. I'm just totally peaceful and totally thankful that you are here visiting me, crazy thought. You do things like that and you know how to meditate. Because what happens? I'm telling you how to meditate. What happens afterwards? You can actually see this logically, but it's much better to see experientially. Because you're not stirring up the mind. Because you're not fighting, you're not wanting. You're letting go of craving, you're going against the stream. You're letting go. And what happens? Things start to get very peaceful. Stillness comes. You don't make it still. You've got to just remove the causes of unstillness. And this is what's happening. The mind gets peaceful. Yeah, it gets dull at first, but the energy starts to come back. And when it comes back big time. You really are alert, energized, powerful, and happy. And that is one of the marvelous parts of Buddhist meditation. Never expected that to happen. But when I meditated, when I learned meditation, I thought all about being still and getting great insights and being enlightened. I never was told it lets you be happy. But this is what happens. You're sitting there doing absolutely nothing. And you notice naturally, without your intentions, without willing it, the corners of your mouth start to go up. And up, and up, and up, until your jaw aches. You feel like laughing out loud. You're getting happy. The happiness in this meditation is meant to happen. It's a sign you're going in the correct direction. It's a signifying that it's actually working. And even to this day, I don't know how many times I go teaching last time in Indonesia, people ask the question, but if you get happy, you'll be attached to it and everything will get wrong. Oh my goodness, You're supposed to get attached to that meditation, to that bliss of meditation. It's part of the path. Even I'd like to, because sometimes people don't believe me, so I get them to quote the suttas. Even in one of the great suttas, the Dhammacaitiya Sutta, the monuments to the Dhamma in the Majjhima Nikaya, that's how it's translated. There the king was visiting the Jeta Grove. It was going to be, he didn't know at the time, his last visit to the Buddha before he died. And there he went into the Jeta Grove and asked the monks, where's the Buddha, where's the Buddha? He said, he's in his hut. He usually can't be disturbed, but if you're a king, maybe he can disturb you. I'm sure if we haven't got a king, maybe if Prince William came to visit me, I would allow myself to be disturbed. I don't know, probably not. But, he said, if you knock on the door, he'll probably let you in, because you're the king anyway. So he knocked on the door, and the Buddha let him into the hut. And this king, this powerful monarch, just went on the floor. He didn't just bow to the Buddha, he grabbed hold of his feet and started kissing it, slobbering all over the Buddha's feet. That's what he did. Please never do that to me. just in case. You'll probably catch some terrible disease. Yeah. That's what he did. And the Buddha just compassionate. So what the heck are you doing, king? It's just a wonderful relationship. It's just so human. So what are you doing? And this king was just saying just how much he loved. I mean, he really loved the Buddha. You know, being a king, just, you know, it's always in this position of loneliness, you know, being a leader. And there was this great sort of Buddha very close by, and you can always go and talk to him as a friend and get this incredibly wonderful advice. And when I read that relationship of King Prasenadi to the Buddha, it's like the Buddha was his grandfather, this benevolent, kind, wise being. And, you know, for a king, it's very rare to have someone like that, a really wise mentor is not after some promotion or some benefit. So he really loved the Buddha, and he was just showing his love. And he said, the Buddha actually asked, well, why do you keep, no, I think the king mentioned, I just love coming to this monastery. Like, you know, some of you love coming to Bodhinyana Monastery, they love going to Dhammasara Monastery. As they sometimes quite surprised, people come all the way from town to bring food to the monks and to the nuns. Why do you do that? Such a long distance. You get up really early in the morning, you have to drive over an hour, and you come there. Not only do you serve the monks food, you also wash up afterwards for us. Now, how many of you would invite your friends to dinner and ask your friends who visit you for dinner to wash up after you? And they also give you a donation for the privilege of feeding and washing up. When you look at it that way, it's crazy, isn't it? But what do you do that for? And they say, oh, we love coming to this monastery. We love going to see the nuns at Dhammasara. And this is exactly like the Buddha was saying, the King Prasenadi, he loved coming there. He said, why do you love coming there, great king? And that's when the king said, because when I come into this monastery, all the monks are happy and smiling. That's why I love coming here. It's this beautiful, happy, smiling place. Because out there in the palace, in the world, you know, in your office, how many people are happy and smiling? How many people are just laughing, cracking jokes, having a good time, smiling and happy to see you? And how many times when you go into the office, you're late. Don't do it again. Don't do what? I don't know, but whatever it is, don't do it again. Sometimes that life is so tough out there. And you go to a monastery, it's nice. But the Buddha actually said, yes, great king, that's what you can expect when the monks are meditating and getting sort of developments in their path of enlightenment. They're supposed to be smiling and happy. And I love quoting that sutta, simply because the Buddha is acknowledging, yes, when your meditation starts to take off, you will be smiley. And people will look upon you as a happy being. And that's to be expected. So to this day, whenever anybody comes and reports on their meditation, like I remember years ago, I was teaching this meditation retreat. That's actually with Ajahn Chah. He was a teacher, but now I was helping him out. And this person came up to me and I asked them, how's your meditation going? And they said, not so good. I can only get second jhana, but I just can't get that third jhana. I've been trying very hard. And that's what they're saying, it with this horizontal mouth. And I looked at them and said, what are you talking about? You haven't got any jhanas. If you had second jhana, you would be just blissed out of your little head. You'd be dancing on air. Your smile would be almost splitting your face in half. Your jaws will be aching. Because that's the bliss you get in these jhanas. So for me, yeah, you can say you've got great insight. Yeah, I've seen the Dharma, I'm a stream winner. If someone says they've seen the Dharma, they're a stream winner, I don't listen to what you say. I look at your facial expression to see whether there's a lot of bliss and happiness and a sense of freedom there. If that's not there, sorry, you're faking it. It's not real. Because that happiness, and you can't fake happiness, that's the great sign your meditation's taking off. That's a great sign your insight is getting powerful. You're blissed out of your little head, having a wonderful time. Because I know those states, when I see it for you, oh, it just makes me, I can recognize what you're going through. Oh, it's wonderful. So I'm emotionally right behind you. Well done. Now that's the sort of thing we're aiming for. This beautiful bliss and happiness. The emotional highs of freedom. You don't get that through wanting. You get liberated from wanting. You don't get that through effort and trying and trying. Wisdom, power, not willpower. The monks of Bodhinyana know that so much now they get sick of it. Wisdom, power, not willpower. So use your wisdom power on this retreat. Get the mind to be perfectly still, free of all wanting. This is what you do, you sit there and it just happens. You're sitting there and just watching all these incredible things. Why is this happening to me? All these great things you read about in the suttas are actually happening, it's real. And you get pissed out of your skull and inspired. That's what I want for each one of you during this retreat. To be sitting there, just tears streaming out of your eyes. So happy, so blessed, free at last. Do you want that? Stupid, don't want it, you'll never get it that way. Let go, be free of all wanting, and have this beautiful time. So, for the rest of today, if you're tired, take a rest. If you've got energy, meditate, but don't want anything. See if you can spend a day of no desire, letting go, being peace, just being here. And understand what Ajahn Chah meant. How do you meditate? How do you eat? It's easy. But if I told you all the rules of eating, if we wrote them down, if Bianca gave you the orientation of how to eat on a retreat, you get so stressed out trying to remember all the rules which you have to keep. And other people be watching you. Are you eating? Are you lifting the fork properly in the right way? And it just, this is life, this is just what really messes up the world. So remember, natural, peaceful, kind, calm, content, easily satisfied, not proud, not demanding in nature. And you'll find your energies will just lift. First day you won't get very much. Second day you'll be energized. Middle of the retreat, you'll be bouncing along like a kangaroo. Having a wonderful time, and just keep on just letting go, and just see just how high you can jump, how blissed out you can be. And with that bliss, your mind will be the perfect mirror. You'll understand the truth of things, because you're experiencing the truth. You'll understand what freedom is, because freedom is right in front of you. You can't miss it. So this is actually how to meditate. Not as you'd expect, giving me stages and instructions, but giving a deeper meaning, and this is how it's done, and you can do it, it's easy to do. So, after a while you get the message, and after a while you get the results. Bliss upon bliss upon bliss. Oh, what joy. Or, as they say in Buddhism, aho sukhang, Aho Sukhang. Aho Sukhang. If you want to learn any Pali, that's the one I recommend. It was stories of these monks sitting under the tree going, Aho Sukhang. Aho Sukhang. Aho Sukhang. Which means, oh, what bliss. Oh, what bliss. Oh, what bliss. So if you want to learn any Pali, those are the two words which are really important. Everything else you don't need to know. Remember? Aho Sukhang. Aho Sukhang. Oh, what bliss. Okay, that's enough, because I've got over time again. But I had a nice time. Okay, so, Aho Sukhang. Enjoy yourself. If you want to go to bed, don't worry about it. You won't sleep in past lunch. Lunch is at 11 o'clock. Your body clock will wake up. If you want to sit here at 11 o'clock, something will disturb you. It's your craving. We'll say, come on, come on, come on, time for lunch. So just enjoy it and don't worry. Okay, see you later.